deeply miraculous virtues. His ability to make a simple meal, his willingness to spend time with his children, always seemed to draw attention to my matching vices. My reliance on cook-chill food, my working weekends in Milan. Now, sitting here in my mother's home, I hear her praise for what it is. The truth about someone who has mum's gift for putting others before themselves. We had tea in this room the first time I brought Rich back to meet her. I was so determined not to be ashamed of where I came from that by the time we got here, after a hot and dogged ride from London, I had stoked myself up into a defiant, take-us-as-you-find-us mood. So what if we don't have matching cutlery? What if my mother says settee instead of sofa? Are you going to make something of it? Are you? Are you? Rich made nothing of it. A natural diplomat, he soon had Mum eating out of his hand, merely by tucking into heroic quantities of bread and butter. I remember how big he looked in our house. The furniture was suddenly doll's furniture, and how gently he negotiated all the no-go areas of my family's past. Dad had walked out by then, but his absence was almost as domineering as his presence had been. Panicked by the idea of Kath's posh boyfriend, my mum, who always goes to too much trouble, had, on that occasion, gone to too little. But Rich volunteered to go to the shop on the corner for extra milk, and came back with two kinds of biscuit and an enthusiasm for the hills whose sooty shoulders you could glimpse from the end of the street. Julie said that some men have been round here asking for money that Dad owes them. With one hand, my mother pats her helmet of grey curls. It's nothing. She'd no need to go bothering you with that. All sorted now. Don't go fretting yourself. I must have pulled a face because she adds, You shouldn't be too hard on your father, love.
Why not? He was hard on us.
Shh! Shh! The iron and my mother chide me simultaneously with their soft sighs. It's not easy for him, you know. He's that bright, but he's not at the outlets, not like you. In your dad's family, there was no question of going on to college. Always liked the sound of medicine, but it was years of studying, and there just wasn't the money. If he's that clever, why does he keep getting himself into trouble? My mother ends conversations she isn't keen on with a non sequitur.
Well, he was always very proud of you, Kath. I had to stop him showing your GCSE certificates to everyone.
She folds the sleeves behind the last blouse and adds it to the basket. There is no sign of the two I bought her last year in Liberties for her birthday, or of other gifts.
Have you worn that red cardigan I got you, Mum?
But it's cashmere, love. Since I've been working, I've bought my mother lovely clothes. I wanted her to have them. I needed her to have them. I wanted to make things all right for her. But she always puts everything I bring her away for best. Best being some indeterminate date in the future when life will at long last live up to its promise.
Can I get you some cake?
No.
Yes, lovely.
On the sideboard, next to the carriage clock purchased a quarter of a century ago with Green Shield stamps, there is a photograph of my parents taken in the late 50s. A seaside place. They're laughing, and behind them the sky is flecked with gulls. They look like film stars. Dad doing his Tyrone Power thing. Mum with her inky Audrey Hepburn eyes and those matador pants that end at the calf and a pair of little black pumps. When I was a child, that photograph used to taunt me with its happiness. I wanted the mother in the picture to come back. I knew that if I waited long enough, she would come back. She was just saving herself for best. Next to the picture is a silver frame containing one of Emily on her second birthday, lit up with glee. Mum follows my glance.
Gorgeous, isn't she?
I nod happily. No matter how battered family relations, a baby can make them new. When Emily was born and Mum came to see us in hospital and laid her hand, speckled with age, on the newborns, I understood how having a daughter could help you to bear the thought of your own mother's death. I wondered then, but never dared ask, whether it helped Mum to bear the idea of leaving Julie and me. There is a clatter of pans from the kitchen.
Mum, please come and sit down.
You just put your feet up, love.
But I want you to sit down. In a minute.
I can't tell her about Richard. How can I tell her?
Julie lives 10 minutes' drive from my mum. Streets in this type of estate were always named after plants and trees, as though that might in some way make amends to the natural environment that had been torn up to build them. But Orchard Way and Elm Drive and Cherry Walk look like cruel taunts now, pastoral notes in a symphony of cement and reinforced glass. My sister's house is in Birch Close, a horseshoe of 60s semi-detached houses hemmed in by properties from succeeding decades, all full of good ideas from town planners for restoring a sense of community so carefully destroyed by town planners. As I pull up in the Volvo, a group of kids who are kicking around on the pavement let out a noise between a cheer and a jeer, but as soon as I climb out and glare at them, they scarper. Even the thugs lack conviction up here. The front garden of number 9 has a circle of earth carved out in the centre of the lawn, with one skinny rhododendron surrounded by clumps of that tiny white flower I always think of as being England's answer to Edelweiss. Parked with one wheel on the ribbed concrete drive, there is a trike that must have been abandoned when Julie's kids were small. In its rusty yellow seat there is a dark compote of leaves and rain. The woman who answers the door is well into middle age, with a listless pageboy haircut, although she is 3 years and 1 month younger than me, a fact I will never forget because my very first memory is of being carried into my parents' bedroom to see her the night she was born. The wallpaper was green. The baby was red and wrapped in a white shawl I had watched my mother knit in front of the stove. She made funny, snuffling sounds, and when you gave her your finger, she wouldn't let go. She was called a sister. I told Mum her name should be Valerie, after my favourite TV presenter. So, thinking they might be spared some jealousy if I had an investment in the new arrival, my parents christened her Julie Valerie Reddy, and she has never let me forget it.
"You'd best come in, then," my sister says. Spotting the car over my shoulder, she tuts and says, "They'll have the tyres off that. Do you want to bring it up the drive? I can clear this stuff."
"No, it'll be fine, really." We squeeze through the narrow hall, with its white wrought iron stand overflowing with spider plants.
"Plants are doing well, Julie," I say. "Can't kill them if you try."
She shrugs.
"There's tea in the pot. Do you want a cup? Stephen, get your feet off the settee. Your Auntie Cass here from London."
A good-looking, small boy, trapped in the body of a lunk, Stephen lollops through to greet me while his mum fetches some cups. I am bringing the news that my husband has left me as a gift to my sister, a peace offering. Julie, who grew up wearing my clothes, who used to overhear teachers comparing her with the other Reddy girl, the one who got to Cambridge, and who has never had anything nicer than I have in her whole life. Well, now her big sister has failed to keep her man, and in this, the oldest contest of all, I can concede defeat.
"Places a tip,"
Julie says, by way of description, not apology, before she clears some magazines off the settee and kicks Stephen's soccer kit towards the door. She sits me down in the armchair next to the gas fire.
"Come on, then. What's up with you?"
"Richard's left me," I say, and it's the first time I've cried since Paula told me on the phone. There were no tears when I explained to Emily that Daddy would be living in a different house for a while because there was no way I wanted to share my distress with a 6-year-old whose idea of men is founded on the prince in Sleeping Beauty, and no tears either when 3 nights ago Richard and I had a civilized exchange on the doorstep about arrangements for the children. We are always discussing arrangements for the children, only the conversation usually ends with me running out the door and saying I have to go. This time it was Richard who walked down the steps and away, yanking over his shoulders the grey sweater I bought him to match his eyes 2 birthdays ago.
"Well, a right useless bugger he turned out to be," Julie says. "All you've got on your plate, and he hops it."
Without my noticing, she has knelt down in front of me and has an arm around my neck. "It's my fault."
"Like hell it is."
"No, it is. It is."
He left a note for me.
A note? Oh, that's great, that is. Bloody men. Either they're too clever to feel out, or they're like our Neil and they're too thick to say out.
Neil's not thick.
When Julie laughs, the little girl I once knew is there in the room, full of fun and not afraid.
No, but you'd have more clue how the hamster's doing than Neil, quite frankly.
Has he got another woman, then, your Richard?
It hadn't even occurred to me.
No, I don't think so. I think it's me that's another woman. The one he married isn't there anymore. He said he couldn't get through to me, that I don't listen to him.
Julie smooths my hair.
Well, you're working too hard to keep him in pencils.
He's a very good architect.
It's you who keeps the show on the road, though, paying all the bills and whatnot.
I think that's hard for him, Jules.
Aye. Well, if the world was run according to what men found hard to take, we'd still be walking round in chastity belts, wouldn't we? Are you having sugar?
No.
Yes. A little later, Julie and I go for a walk up to the recreation ground at the top of the estate. The path is choked with ferns, and there is a burnt-out fiesta threaded with foxgloves. When we get to the swings, we find a couple of schoolgirl mothers sitting there on the bench. Teenage pregnancy ranks as a hobby round here. These two are pretty typical. Waxy with tiredness and caked in makeup, they look like cadavers with their young jumping up and down on them, full of rude life. Julie tells me that the breathlessness and the pains in our mother's chest date from a few months back when a couple of Dad's creditors turned up at the door. Mum explained that Joseph Reddy didn't live there anymore, had not in fact lived there for many years, but the men came in anyway and looked over the furniture, the carriage clock, the silver frames I'd given her for the children's photographs. Younger than me, and not cursed with the elder child's desperate need for approval, Julie managed to stay outside the immediate blast area of Dad's charm, and for most of our lives has observed him coldly and without fear of side effects. I tell her about the day he came to see me at the office, and she explodes with indignation.
Bloody typical, that is. Not worried about embarrassing you in front of your boss. What does he think he's playing at?
He's designed a biodegradable nappy.
Him? He's never seen a baby's bum in his life.
And we both start to laugh, my sister and I, great snorts of laughter escaping through our mouths and our noses and finally running in tears down our cheeks. From a corner of my coat pocket, I produce a hanky crusty with use. Julie volunteers one in a similar condition, but spotted with blood.
Emily's carol concert.
Stephen's rugby match.
We turn and look out across the town. Its ugliness is draped in a ludicrous Vivian Westwood sunset, all knicker pink tulle and scandalous purples. The skyline is dominated by large chimneys, but only a few are still active. They let out quick, small puffs like furtive smokers.
You didn't give Dad out, I hope,
Julie says, and when I don't reply,
oh, bloody hell, Kath, you're a soft touch.
City Ice Maiden, I announce in my Radio 4 voice.
Ice Maiden that melts pretty easily, snapped my sister. You've got to get over Dad, you know. He's not worth it. There's millions of crap dads out there. We're nothing special. Remember the way he used to send you to the door when they came round asking for the rent money? You remember that, don't you?
No.
You do remember. I know you do. That's no way to treat a kid, Kathy, getting them to lie for you. And he thumped Mum when things weren't going his way.
No.
No? Who was it that went downstairs to distract him when they were beating the shit out of each other? Little girl name of Catherine. Ring any bells?
Jules, what were those ice lollies with the hundreds and thousands on them called?
Don't change the bloody subject.
Do you remember?
Course I do. Fabs. But you never had them. Always saved your pocket money and bought the Cornish Mivy. Mum said you always had to have the best of everything from when you could stand up. Champagne tastes on beer money, that's our Kath. So you went and made the money for the champagne, didn't you?
It's not that great, I say, studying my wedding band.
Bubbly?
Julie looks at me as though she really wants to know. How can I tell my sister that money has improved my life, but it hasn't deepened it or eased it? Oh, you spend most of your money trying to buy yourself time and to make money to pay for all the things you think you need because you've got money. Yes, but it's better than that. Julie gestures across the recreation ground to the child mothers. She speaks angrily, but when she says it again, it sounds like a blessing. It's got to be better than that, love. There was a Mr. Whippy van that used to go round our estate, playing a hectic version of Greensleeves. One day, during the summer holidays, Annette and Colin Terry were buying an ice cream from the van when their kitten ran out and got caught in the back wheel. We yelled, but the driver didn't hear us, and the van started pulling away. I remember it was boiling hot. The tarmac was rearing up in the road, and it stuck in clumps on the bottom of our sandals like rabbit droppings. And I remember the way Annette screamed, and I remember the music, and the sense of something infinitely gentle being broken as the wheel spun round. The Terrys lived two doors down from us. Carol Terry was the only mother we knew who went out to work. She started off doing some bar work for pin money, and soon after she got a full-time job in the accounts office of a metals factory. Dissecting their neighbours over elevenses, my mother and Mrs. Frieda Davies decided that Carol spent her wages on going to the hairdresser and other things that came under the category of enjoying herself. They couldn't have been more delighted when Annette failed her 11+. Well, what can you expect with no one at home to get the poor child a cooked tea? Me, I remember Carol wearing lipstick and laughing a lot and seeming younger than my mother, whose birthday she shared. The day of the accident, Mum heard our screams and ran out and took us all inside while the Mr. Whippy man tried to clear up the mess. I had dropped my strawberry Cornish Mivy on the road. Mum calmed Annette down, made orange squash for everyone, and found Colin a plaster. He had no graze or cut, but he needed a plaster. And then she gave the Terrys their tea while we all waited for their mum to get home from work. Carol arrived late and flustered with shopping bags. She had got Mum's phone message, but she had been unable to get away any quicker. When I think back to how it was when Carol came into the kitchen and us all sitting at the formica table, I can remember the heat hanging there like wet towels and Colin spilling his squash and how Annette wouldn't look at her mum. But I can't remember if it went unsaid, the thing everyone was thinking. Did anyone say it? But if you'd been here, the kitten wouldn't be dead. Chapter 35. No Answers. 6:35 p.m. And furthermore, there is a good deal of evidence that mixed gender teams are critical to effective team functioning.
Jesus, Katie, I never thought I'd hear you say anything like that.
Rod Task is unimpressed, and he's not the only one. The place is full of people who'd rather be in the wine bar than being addressed by me in my new capacity as diversity coordinator. I feel like a vegan at an abattoir. Chris Bunce lies back in his chair with his feet up on the conference table.
I'm all for mixing genders, he says, stifling a yawn.
Can we get the hell out of here now? Asks Rod.
No, says Celia Harmsworth. We need to produce a mission statement.
As the room groans, there is an answering thrum from the phone in my pocket. A text message from Paula. Ben ill. Come now.
I've got to go, I say. Urgent call coming in from the States. Don't wait for me.
I call Paula from the cab on the way home. She fills me in. Ben fell downstairs.
You know that dodgy bit of carpet near the top of the stairs by his room, Kate?
Please, God, no.
Yes, I do. Well, he caught his foot somehow, and he fell and bumped his head this morning. It came up a bit, but he seemed as right as rain. Then he was sick a bit ago, and he went all limp.
I tell Paula to keep him warm, or should she be keeping him cool? Numb, my fingers feel like stumps as I dial Richard's mobile number. I pray for it to be him, but it's the voice of that damned announcer saying, please leave a message.
Hello? I don't want to leave a message. I want you to be here. It's me, Kate. Ben's had a fall and I'm taking him to the hospital. I'll have my phone with me.
Next, I call Pegasus Cars and ask for Winston to be waiting when I get home. Need to get Ben to hospital.
8:23 p.m. How long is too long to wait for your child to be seen? Ben and I are told to take a seat in the rows of grey plastic chairs. Next to us are a couple of public schoolboys who are off their heads on something. Ecstasy, probably.
I've got no feeling in my fingers, wails one over and over, pretending he has no idea why.
I don't care. I want to tell him to get back to whatever overprivileged swamp he came from and expire quietly. The idea that this kind of jerk is wasting hospital time is so disgusting, I want to slap him.
Winston, who has gone to park Pegasus, returns and approaches the reception desk. Seeing me drained, he stands in and becomes the pushy one.
Excuse me, miss. We got a baby here and needs some attention. Thank you kindly.
After an eternity, maybe 5 minutes, Ben and I are ushered in to see the doctor. Half slept and unshaven since last Thursday, the young houseman is seated in a cubicle cut off from the busy corridor by a thin apricot curtain. I start to explain Ben's symptoms, but he silences me with a hand while he studies the notes on the desk in front of him.
I see.
And how long has the little boy had a temperature, Mrs. Shattuck?
Well, I'm not entirely sure. He was very hot up until an hour ago.
And earlier today?
I don't know.
The doctor moves to put his hand on Ben's forehead, who mews slightly as I relax my grip on him.
Sickness? Vomiting in the past 24 hours?
I think he was sick yesterday afternoon, but Paula thought, she's my nanny, we thought it was just a bad tummy.
Bowel movement since then?
I'm afraid I don't know.
So you didn't see him at all yesterday?
Yes. No, I mean, I tried to get home in time to put him to bed, but not last night, no.
And not the night before?
No, I had to go to Frankfurt. You see, Ben fell down the stairs this morning, and he seemed to be fine, but then Paula got really worried, and he became limp, so...
Yes, I see.
I don't think he sees. I must try to talk calmly and slowly, so he sees.
Can you undress baby for me?
I slip him out of his Thomas the Tank sleep suit, undo the poppers at the crotch of his vest, and pull it over his head. The skin is so fair it's almost translucent, and through the rack of ribs you can see the tiny bellows of his lungs.
And the baby's weight? What does he weigh now, Mrs. Shattuck?
I'm not entirely sure. He must be about 28 or 30 pounds, I think.
When did you last have him weighed?
Well, he had his 18-month check, but you know he's my second, and you're not as worried about things like weight with the second, so long as they're...
And at the 18-month check, his weight was...
As I said, I'm not sure, but Paula said he was absolutely fine.
And Benjamin's date of birth? You are familiar with that, I presume.
The insult is so biting that the tears jump to my eyes as if I had walked out into snow. I do really well in tests. I know the answers, but I don't know these answers, and I should know. I know I should know. Ben was born on the 25th of January. He is very strong and very happy, and he never cries, only if he is tired or if his teeth hurt. And his favourite book is Owl Babies, and his favourite song is The Wheels on the Bus, and he is my dearest, sweetest, only son, and if anything happens to him, I will kill you, and then I will burn down your hospital, and then I will kill myself.
The 25th of January.
Thank you, Mrs. Shattuck. Now, little man, let's take a look at that chest.
12:17 a.m. I don't know how I would have managed without Winston. He stayed all the time with us at the hospital, fetching sweet tea for me from the machine, holding Ben when I had to go to the loo, and only showing any sign of upset when I offered to pay him for his time. As he helps me and the sleeping baby out of the cab, I can just make out a figure on the steps of our house. I think that if it's a mugger, I won't be responsible for my actions. But a few steps nearer, and I realize that it's Momo. Can't bear to see anyone from work. Not now.
Whatever it is, surely it could have waited till morning, I say, stabbing the key in the lock. I'm sorry, Kate. Sorry doesn't really cover it, I'm afraid. I've just got back with Ben from the hospital. He's been under observation. It's been a long night. If the Hang Seng fell 10%, I don't give a shit, frankly, and you can tell Rod that in those precise words. Oh, God, what is it? In the blade of light that the opening door casts into the street, I suddenly see that Momo has been crying. It's a shock to find that perfect face puffed up with misery. I'm sorry, she says, and can say nothing else because speaking has triggered a fresh bout of crying. I get her inside and sit her in the kitchen while I take Ben up to his cot. A viral rash, the doctor called it, unconnected to his fall. We just have to be sure to keep baby's fluids up for the next 24 hours and keep an eye on his temperature. Turning the corner to the flight of stairs that leads up to the kids' rooms, I see the patch of worn carpet where Ben tripped. I hate that carpet. I hate the fact that I didn't get a quote for a new one. I hate the fact that finding the time to call someone out to measure my stairs seemed like an impossible luxury when it was a necessity all along. Triage, the order of urgency. I got it wrong. Things that could harm the children come first. Everything else can wait. Looking in on Emily, I find her curled around Paula, who has fallen asleep on the bed. I go in and switch off the Cinderella light and cover them both with the duvet. Back downstairs in the kitchen, I make a pot of mint tea and try to get some sense out of Momo. 10 minutes later, I understand why she is having trouble explaining the problem. She simply doesn't have a vocabulary crude enough to describe what she has seen. After work tonight, Momo went to 171, a bar opposite Liverpool Street, with a bunch of people from the US desk. Later she dropped by the office to collect some files for our forthcoming final. Chris Bunce was there, with a group of guys all gathered round his screen, laughing and making raucous comments. They included her friend Julian, who joined EMF the same day Momo did last year. The men didn't hear her come in, and they didn't notice until too late that she had come over to look at what they were looking at.
Pictures of a woman, you know, Kate, wearing nothing. I mean, worse than nothing.
But they download that stuff all the time, Momo.
You don't understand, Kate. They were pictures of me.
2:10 a.m. I have helped Momo upstairs, found her some nightclothes, and tucked her up in the guest bed. Floundering in my Gap XXXL t-shirt with the Dachshund motif, she looks about 8 years old. Calmer now, she manages to tell me the whole story. Apparently she screamed at the top of her voice when she saw the pictures on the screen, demanding to know who had done this. Bunce, naturally, toughed it out, turned to Momo and said,
"Well, now the real thing is here. Perhaps she'd like to show us what she can do, guys."
They all laughed at that, but when she started crying, they left the office pretty quickly. Only Julian hung around and tried to calm her down. Eventually she yelled at him until he told her Bunce had taken headshots of Momo from the EMF website, the ones the firm was using in its brochure to illustrate its commitment to diversity, and digitally spliced them onto other women's bodies that are freely available on the net.
"Bodies with no clothes on," Momo repeats, and her primness makes it doubly painful.
Momo says she stopped looking when she saw her own head giving head. There were captions to go with the pictures, but she found it hard to make them out because she dropped her glasses and they cracked on the trading floor.
"There was something about Asian babes, I think."
"There would be."
"What are we going to do?" she asks,
and the "we" feels both presumptuous and entirely right. "Nothing is what we're going to do. We'll think of something." I put the main light out and leave the bedside lamp on. Next to it, in a vase, is a desiccated sprig of lily of the valley, left over from Donald and Barbara's visit.
"I don't understand, Kate," Momo says. "Why would Bunce do that? Why would anyone want to do that?"
"Oh, because you're beautiful, and you're female, and because he can. It's not very complicated." For a second, she ignites with anger. Are you saying what Chris Bunce did to me was nothing personal?
No.
Yes.
I suddenly feel exorbitantly tired, as though my veins were filled with lead. The terror of there being something wrong with Ben, and now this. Why do I always have to explain things to Momo, important things, when I'm at my most stupid? I lay my hand on her cool brown one and will the words to come. I'm saying that there was all history, and now there's us. There's never been anything like us before, Momo. Century after century of women knowing their place, and suddenly it's 20 years of women who don't know their place, and it's scary for men. It's happened so fast. Chris Bunce looks at you, and he sees someone who's supposed to be an equal. We know what he wants to do to you, but he's not allowed to touch anymore, so he fakes pictures of you that he can do what he likes with. Under the duvet she shakes, the shudder of a still fresh shame, and tightens her grip on my fingers. Momo, do you know how long they reckon it took for early man to stand upright?
How long?
Between 2 and 5 million years. If you give Chris Bunce 5 million years, he may realize that it's possible to work alongside women without needing to take their clothes off. I can see the opal precipitate of tears in her eyes.
You're telling me we can't do anything, Kate, aren't you? About Bunce. I just have to put up with it, because that's what they're like, and there's no use trying to change anything.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
No, I wouldn't put it quite like that.
As Momo sighs and winces her way to sleep, I go downstairs to switch off the lights and lock up. I miss Richard all the time, but this is the time I miss him most. Locking up is his job, and the bolt feels less safe when I draw it across, the creaking in the window frames more ghostly. As I close the shutters, I keep thinking of what will happen over the next few days. In the morning, Momo Gumarantney will make a formal complaint about the behavior of Christopher Bunce to her line manager, Rod Task. Task will refer the complaint to Human Resources. Momo will then be suspended on full pay, pending an internal inquiry. At the first meeting of the inquiry, which I will be invited to attend, it will be publicly noted that Momo Gumarantney is of previously impeccable character. It will be silently noted that Chris Bunce is our leading performer, who last year moved £400 million of business. Quite soon, the offence against Momo will be referred to as a bad business, or simply that Bunce business. After 3 months at home, enough time for her to start feeling anxious and depressed, Momo will be called into the office. A financial settlement will be offered. The Cheltenham lady in her will stand up straight and say she cannot be bought off. All she wants is to see justice done. The inquiry panel will be shocked. They too want justice to be done. It's just that the nature of the evidence is, how shall we say, problematic. Casually, imperceptibly, it will be implied that Momo's career in the city could be over. She is a young woman of exceptional promise, but these things have a way of being misinterpreted. No smoke without fire. All tremendously unfortunate. If news of the pornographic computer images, say, were to get out to the media... 2 days later, Momo Gumarantney will settle out of court for an undisclosed sum. When she walks down the steps of Edwin Morgan Forster for the last time, a woman reporter from the TV news will poke a microphone in her face and ask her to give details of what happened. Is it true that they called her an Asian babe and ran porno pictures of her? Lowering her lovely head, Momo will decline to comment. Next day, 4 newspapers will run a story on page 3. One headline reads, "Asian Babe in City Porn Pic Storm." Momo's denial will appear in the second-to-last paragraph. Soon after, she will take a job abroad and pray to be forgotten. Bunce will hold on to his job, and the black mark against his character will be erased by a steady tide of profits. And nothing will change. That much is certain. As I'm reaching for the light switch, I notice a new picture stuck to the fridge under the Tinky Winky magnet. It's a drawing of a woman with yellow hair. She is wearing a stripy brown suit, and her heels are as high as stilts. The glare from the light means it's hard to make out the writing in pencil underneath. I go up close. The artist is Emily, and with the help of a teacher she has written,
"My mummy goes out to work, but she thinks about me all day long."
Did I really say that to her? Must have. Em remembers absolutely everything. I heave open the freezer and force my face into its arctic air. The impulse to get in and keep walking is immense. I'm going in now. I may be some time. Back upstairs, I look in on Momo. Her lids are closed, but the eyes beneath them flutter like moths. Dreaming, poor baby. I'm turning the lamp off when the eyes open and she whispers, "What are you thinking, Kate?" "Oh, I was just thinking about what I said to you the day we first met." "You said that I had to stop saying sorry." "Too damn right you do. And what else?" She stares up at me with that trusting spaniel look I saw at the final all those eons ago. "You said that compassion, although expensive, is not necessarily a waste of money." "I didn't say that."
"You did?"
"God, how appalling. I'm such a cow. What else did I say?"
"You said that money can't tell what sex you are."
"Exactly."
"Exactly?"
she echoes uncertainly. "Where does it hurt them most, Momo? Where can we hurt them the most?" All that night, I couldn't sleep. I kept creeping into Ben's room, checking his breathing as I used to check Emily's when I first brought her home and worried she would never wake. Ben slept on and on, but there was nothing to be afraid of. He was sleeping like a baby. Richard rang about 2. He was in Brussels pitching for a Euro grant for a Northern Art Centre and had only just got my message. He asked me if I was okay, and I said no. He said we needed to talk, and I said yes. At 5:30, I rang Candy, who I knew was being woken early by the baby kicking in her ribs, told her about the pictures of Momo on the system. I had no idea what we could do about it, but I thought she might, with her background in internet companies. Between 5:50 and 6:30, she wrote a program that would seek and destroy all files containing references to Momo Gumarantni.
"It'll be hard tracking down any stuff that's gone out of the building," she said, "but I can nix anything still held in the EMF system."
We agreed that she should keep one copy of the pictures for evidence. At 6 o'clock, Momo came into the kitchen and held something up.
"I found this in my bed. Does it belong to anybody?"
I went across and hugged her.
"That's Roo. He's a member of the family."
Giving her a cup of tea to take back to bed, I walked up with her and went into Ben's room. Still fast asleep, I tucked Roo next to his cheek. In a very short time, one little boy was going to be happier than Christmas. Going into my own bedroom, I opened the wardrobe and ran my hand along the rail until I got to my finest Armani armor, a crow black suit. From the rack beneath, I chose a pair of patent heels with snakeskin toes, heels it was impossible to walk in, but walking wasn't really the point today. As I got dressed, I went through all the resources I could draw on, the forces I could muster. I wanted Richard to come home, and I knew now that I would do whatever it took to make that happen. But first, Mummy had to finish her work. Must remember, destroy Bunce. Chapter 36. The Sting. It was generally agreed that the business plan for Power's biodegradable nappy was an exceptional document. Over 30 handsome pages of A4, it featured details of the target market for the miracle new nappy and the projected growth rate. There was an impressive rundown on the competition, a review of the environmental advantages, and a detailed implementation plan. The figures were excellent, without being unduly optimistic. The CVs of the management team were first-rate, particularly that of the inventor himself, Joseph R. Power, who, it was noted, had enjoyed connections with the Apollo space program and subsequent lucrative spin-offs. The patent for the biodegradable nappy was still pending, but the patent application, which described the product in crystalline detail, left you in no doubt of its success. Under the circumstances,
it seemed a pity that only one person would get to see the document. The target market for Power's biodegradable nappy was not a billion leaky babies, but a Mr. Christopher Bunce. Bunce was now the head of EMF's venture capital unit. This was good news in two ways. First, it made it easier to get him to take a huge punt on my dad's crappy nappy. Gambling on exciting new products before anyone else got to them was part of the job. Second, Veronica Pick, the number two on venture capital, who had been expecting to get the top job herself and was furious at having to make way for a novice in the area, could be relied upon not to steer her new boss clear of any minefields, might indeed be persuaded to guide him towards one with a friendly smile. Friday noon, the Suckling Club.
Okay, so let's go through this one more time.
Candy is not even attempting to hide her scorn.
Your dad, a guy who can't remember the name of his own kids and has never, to anyone's knowledge, seen their tushes, has invented a diaper that's going to change the face of world diaperdom, except that we know the diaper doesn't work because you have tried the prototype on your son, Benjamin, and when Benjamin took a... Candy, please. All right, when Ben needed to go to the bathroom, the diaper fell apart. So what we're going to do is we're going to sell the diaper project to the new chief of our own venture capital unit, who, being an arrogant cocksucker and knowing even less than your dad about little kids, will invest thousands of dollars in the great diaper adventure and will then lose all that money because... Remind me of the because, Kate? Because my father's company is heavily in debt and the money EMF invests will be claimed by his creditors, and the nappy company will immediately go into liquidation, and Bunce will lose his shirt, his socks, and his poxy boxers, and be exposed for the appalling chanker he is. Do you have any problem with the plan, Candy? No, it sounds great.
She sniffs the air as though testing a new perfume.
I just need to hear from you how we are going to keep our jobs when I'm about to become a single mom, and, until Slow Richard returns to the Ready Ranch, you are a de facto single mom.
Candy, there's a principle at stake here. She looks momentarily alarmed.
Oh, I get it. It's our old friend Oates.
Who?
The snowman. The one you told Rod about? Pardon me, gentlemen. I'm going out now, and I may be some fucking time.
That's not a plot, Katie. That's a noble act of meaningless self-sacrifice. Very British. But you know, in the States, we have this really weird thing where we like the good guys to be alive at the end of the movie.
Not all self-sacrifice is meaningless, Candy.
My friend detonates her big laugh, and everyone in the club turns to stare nervously at the pregnant woman.
Whoa, she says. You're beautiful when you're ethical.
Look, there will be nothing to link you to the nappy deal, I promise.
So all roads will lead to Ready? You know that after this no one's going to employ you ever again, Kate. Nobody. You're not going to get hired to change the fucking fax paper.
With this dire warning, Candy reaches across, takes my hand, and guides it onto the swell of her bump. Through the drum-taut skin, I feel the unmistakable jab of a heel. This is the first time she has acknowledged the baby as something permanent, not disposable, and I know better than to say anything mushy.
Is it kicking a lot?
Uh-huh.
When I'm taking a bath, you can see her going crazy in there. It's like some goddamn dolphin show.
It's not necessarily a girl, Cand.
Hey, I'm a girl, she's a girl, okay?
Candy clocks my smile and quickly adds,
"Course, I can still get her adopted."
Of course. I seem to recall it was Candy's idea that seven women meeting in secret in the city would look less conspicuous in a lap dancing club than in, say, a restaurant where people were wearing clothes. Sitting here, I wish I had a Polaroid camera to capture the expressions on the faces of my friends as they enter the venue. In the case of Momo, good breeding immediately conquers shock, and she sweetly inquires of the blonde at the desk,
"Oh, how long have you been open?"
We are not the only women in the Suckling Club. A gentleman's entertainment emporium, located within easy reach of the world's premier financial district. But we are the only ones with unexposed breasts. Everyone who has turned up this lunchtime has important work to do. I already know that Chris Bunce is greedy and ambitious enough to plough money into a project without running it by anyone on his team. Why would he want to share the credit if he can take it all himself? But I also know that we will have to do a highly professional job on the biodegradable nappy to get him to buy it. Dad's drawing of a winged pig has to be upgraded. There needs to be a brochure, knowledge of the market and production, plus input from a top commercial lawyer. When I called Deborah, I was scared she would say no. Our string of cancelled lunches over the past year had stretched our friendship to twanging point, but she didn't need to be asked twice. Without ever having met Chris Bunce, Deb knew instantly what manner of man he was and what we had to do to him. So our merry band consists of Candy, me, Deborah and Momo, and Judith and Caroline from my old mother and baby group. We're still waiting for Alice. It was vital for Alice, who's a TV producer, to help us out, but I didn't hear back from her, so I assumed she wanted no part in it. Luckily, she phoned me this morning, said she'd been away filming, and she'd be delighted to join us, although she'd be late. A patent agent, before becoming a full-time mum, Judith has written the patent application for the nappy, and made it so convincing I want to order a truckload for Ben immediately. In her cool marshalling of language and science, I see a side to Judith I have never known. Caroline, the graphic designer, has come up with a brochure which stresses the nappy's eco-friendliness and has featured an irresistible picture of her own baby, Otto, sitting on a potty made of lettuce leaves. Deborah is handling the legal side of things. She tells me that EMF will have no comeback against my father. Look, this isn't fraud. It's naughty, but it's not illegal. And it's a clear case of caveat emptor. If the buyer doesn't take care over what he's buying, then that's his lookout. Deb will be acting as my dad's lawyer during the meeting he will need to have with Chris Bunce, which we have arranged to be held in a suite at the Savoy. You have no idea how brilliant I am at this, Deb exclaims as she takes me through the documentation. What are we going to call ourselves? The Seven Deadly Sisters? Deb, this is serious. I know, but I haven't had so much fun since Enid Blyton. God, Kate, I've missed fun, haven't you? Momo has been given the task of researching the global nappy market. In a few short days, she has become an incredible bore on urine dispersal and olfactory containment. I'm sorry, Kate, but are you aware of how many insults the average nappy can sustain? I can get that stuff at home, thank you. My assistant looks anxious. It won't work, will it? The plan? No, the nappy. Of course it won't. How can you be sure, Kate? If Bunce made a killing, I couldn't bear it. Well, my dad designed it, so it's an odds-on catastrophe. Plus, I took a prototype home and put it on Ben. And? It's so biodegradable it falls apart at the first poo. Alice arrives late at the club from a meeting with the BBC at White City. Over the throbbing music, she points at the girls on stage and mouths, "Are we auditioning?" Alice's role begins after Bunce has invested in the nappy. It's a pincer movement of the kind deployed by generals in all those battles I used to know the names of. Attack him on one flank and then cut off his route of escape. Evidence that Bunce has recklessly thrown away money on a duff product may not be enough to get Edwin Morgan Forster to sack him, but if he says embarrassing things in an interview, which Alice records and gets into print, then he'll become a liability with the clients, and basically he's hanging from a meat hook in Smithfield. Shouting over the bass track, Alice tells me she has already called Bunce and invited him to appear in a major BBC Two series on money makers. The city made sexy for the person on the couch. How did he take it? Asks Momo, who is more nervous than the rest of us. Alice grins. He practically came down the phone. I don't think I'll have any trouble persuading him to talk. I try to call the meeting to order, but I am competing with Mamma Mia. Instead, I hand round a photocopy of what everyone needs to know, plus a picture of Chris Bunce, which Candy has lifted from the EMF website. I excuse myself and head for the ladies' room. In the corner booth at the back, next to the exit, is a dark-haired figure I vaguely recognize. A little closer, and I know exactly who it is.
Jeremy! Jeremy Browning!
I greet my client with a warmth and volume that will sing in his soul forever.
Well, fancy seeing you here, I enthuse. And this must be... it's Annabelle, isn't it?
The girl sitting on my client's left thigh gives a look that is smirk, sneer, and smile combined. It says that unfortunately she is not Mrs. Browning, but wouldn't say no if offered the chance. I extend a friendly hand towards the girl, but it is Jeremy who grasps it eagerly.
Gosh, Kate, he says, I didn't expect to see you here.
Well, I'm doing some research into expanding my leisure portfolio. Maybe you can give me some pointers. This sector is new to me. Fascinating, isn't it? Well, must go. Lovely to meet you. Cheryl. Lovely to meet you, Cheryl. Look after him for me. I walk away, confident that I have at least one man in my power for all eternity. When I get back to the table, Candy is busy pointing out which of the girls on stage she believes to have had a boob job, and how successful it has been.
Christ, look at the poor kid with the red hair. I thought they were going to remove all nuclear weapons from British soil.
You should have seen the state of my tits when I had twins, says Judith, who is on her third Mai Tai. I watch in horror as the dancer in question leaves the stage and advances upon us, cupping her breasts in the way a dog breeder holds up puppies for inspection.
Now that's what I call juggling, shouts Alice. The work-life balance. What do you reckon, Kate?
Her pelvic floor must be in good shape, says Caroline, pointing to another dancer who is making Mr. Whippy motions as though trying to give birth to an ice cream.
What's the pelvic floor?
Ask Candy and Momo together. When I explain, Candy, who thinks prenatal classes are all run by communists, doesn't hide her disgust.
But the pelvic thingy goes back into place after the birth, right?
And the dance floor shudders, and the women around the table laugh and laugh, and the men in the club look uncomfortable in the way that only women's laughter can make them uncomfortable. I raise my glass.
Screw our courage to the sticking place and we'll not fail.
Die Hard too? Asks Momo.
No, Lady Macbeth.
What are they teaching them these days?
Chapter 37. Lunch with Robin. When Robin Cooper Clark is ill at ease, he looks like a man trying to arrest himself, one arm clasped tight around his own chest, the other hooked around his neck. This is how uncomfortable he looks on our walk to Sweeting's, 3 days after the meeting in the Suckling Club. The restaurant is quite a distance from the office, but Robin is absolutely insistent that we eat there, so as he marches out with his 7-league stride, I scurry along, taking 3 paces to his 1. Sweeting's is a city institution, a fish place that wants to look like a fishmonger's. Lots of cheery shouting, bustle, marble slabs. It's like a Billingsgate for the moneyed classes. There are counters at the front where people can sit on high stools and pick at crab, and at the back there is a room with long tables like a school canteen. Looking around, it strikes me that there are men in here who have moved from prep to public school to Oxbridge, and then on to the city or the bar, and never had any contact with the world as everyone else knows it. If privilege is another country, Sweeting's is its corner cafe. Robin and I are seated at the far end of one of the long communal tables.
Bad business, this Bunce thing,
he mutters, studying the menu.
Momo Gumarantney seems a good thing.
She's terrific.
And Bunce?
Toxic.
I see. Now, what are we going to have?
The waiter stands there, pen at the ready, and for the first time I notice what a mess Robin is. The right wing of his shirt collar is furrowed like a brow, and there are commas of shaving foam in his ears. Jill would never have let him out of the house looking like that.
Ah, yes. I think something ferocious with teeth for the lady, and an endangered species for me. Turtle soup, perhaps? Or is it cod that's been fished to death by the bloody Spaniards? What do you reckon, Kate?
I'm still laughing when Robin says, Kate, I'm getting married again.
And it's as though the noise in the room is turned off at the tap. The diners around me mouth mutely like the fish they're about to consume. And suddenly I know why he's brought me here, to this restaurant, to this room. It's a place where you can't shout in anger or cry out in pain. A place indeed for sweeting, for bonhomie, for a mild bollocking at worst. A man's kind of place. How many souls have been grilled at these tables with a smile? How many politely encouraged to step down or step aside over a surprisingly decent glass of Chablis? Now I feel as though it's Jill Cooper-Clarke who's been let go, and me who has to do the decent thing. Look interested, pleased even, instead of upending the table and leaving the men gaping with their napkins and their bones. Only 6 months dead. I become aware that Robin has started to tell me about someone called Sally. Lovely, incredibly kind, used to boys, got two of her own. Not quite Jill's speed, but then who is? Helpless shrug. And she has so many qualities, this Sally, and the boys need, well, Alex, he's just 10, he still needs a mother. And you, I say, finding some words in the dry vault of my mouth. You need her.
I need a woman, yes, Kate. We're not much good on our own, you know.
He waves away the proffered tartar sauce.
I can see how you might find that...
What?
Feeble, I suppose.
He lowers his glass and pinches the bridge of his nose.
No one can ever replace her, if that's what you're thinking.
Then why replace her, if she's irreplaceable? That's what I'm thinking. I feel caved in with sadness, as I did that day at Jill's funeral. I always knew where to find Robin. He always seemed so rooted and so reliable. Looking at him now across the table, it's a shock to see a lost boy. Men without wives might as well be men without mothers. They are more orphans than widowers. Men without wives, they lose their spines, their ability to walk tall in the world, even to wipe the shaving foam from their ears. Men need women more than women need men. Isn't that the untold secret of the world? I'm so glad for you, I say. Jill would be really pleased. I know she couldn't bear the idea of you not managing. Robin nods, grateful to get the news out of the way. Glad to pull up the drawbridge once more. With the plates cleared away, we turn to the menu again and study it like an exam paper.
How about a treacle tart with two spoons? Says Robin. Have you heard they're looking for a new name for Spotted Dick, Kate?
Chris Bunce.
Sorry?
Spotted Dick. Bunce is the venereal disease champion of the office. Ask any of the secretaries. Robin dabs his mouth with his napkin.
It makes you very angry, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. For a moment, I consider telling him about the plan. But as my superior, he would be obliged to veto it, and as my friend and mentor, he would probably do the same. Instead, I say, I don't think someone should be allowed to go on being a shit because it's not convenient to stop him. Robin semaphores to the waiter for the bill.
Jill always said you can get a man to do anything so long as he doesn't notice he's being made to do it.
Did she do that to you?
I never noticed.
3:13 p.m. I leave Robin at the corner of Cheapside